It was the first time I had ever heard that you could get a degree in winemaking, and I said, that's for me.
Robert Parker has established himself as a critical reviewer with an acute palate. I'm just wondering where that female is.
The wine industry is addicting. It draws you back.
To me, the romance is in the glass, and it's when you're done with the bottle.
And we would spend our summer afternoons swimming in the irrigation pond for 3 to 4 hours a day.
Even though it's tough work, nobody said it would ever be easy. You know, we do it as a family.
In the final analysis, somebody's going to pop the cork, and they're either going to like the wine or they're not going to like the wine.
Since I made Cabernet all my life at Beringer, I buy Cabernet, so you should never let a winemaker own their own winery.
We were either going back to Switzerland to go to hotel school, or we were going to come to California. We had to get closer to the vineyard thing.
It's like when you go to one of those winemaker dinners where the winemaker doesn't quite get that not everyone is telling jokes about the acid level in the wine all night.
We say, so drink the wine. That's kind of our motto here at Life Between the Vines. One of the cool things about wine, besides drinking it, is the people you drink it with. And the stories you hear and tell with wine all come together to make every bottle unique. Discovering and tasting wine shouldn't be a homework assignment. And we believe that the people who are closest to wine have the best stories. So open a bottle. And welcome to podcast number 97. This week, we feature winemaker Brooks Painter of Castello di Amarosa in Napa Valley.
The story is simply amazing. A castle in Napa Valley. Castello di Amarosa sits, hugely, at the northern end of Napa Valley in Calistoga. 107 rooms, 95 dedicated to winemaking, and lots to see and taste. Brooks Painter is the director of winemaking for the label, and we spent a little time with him chatting about life in a castle. I'm here with Brooks Painter, and Brooks is the winemaker, I'm not sure, director of winemaking, is that the official title?
Director of winemaking, yeah, Castello di Amarosa.
Thank you for saying it instead of me saying it. How are you doing today?
Oh, great, thanks. Great. We're out here in Napa Valley just before the Napa Valley auction, so it's an exciting week.
It's kind of an electric week, you know. There's so much that goes on. There's so many events that happen before it, and you guys are going to be there this year, correct?
That's right. We're participating on Friday at the barrel auction, so we'll be bringing over a whole barrel of our Il Barone Cabernet Sauvignon for people to sample and bid on Friday.
Il Barone, is that the vineyard designate then, or...?
No, it's actually a proprietary name, the Baron would be the translation, and it's one of our top Cabernets. It's usually sourced from a few different vineyards, but we've been making this since 2003. Mm-hmm. So, in fact, 2012 was our 10th anniversary of making that wine.
The thing about being here at the castle is, there's like a million questions, but let's talk about you for a few minutes first, and then we'll come back to the castle. Was there a point in your life all of a sudden where wine knocked you over the head? What was it like for you?
Well, there was a couple of, I guess you might call them, seminal moments where I ran across some wines that were very impressive. Back in my university days, I was on a pre-med track, actually, and I was doing biology and chemistry in preparation for that. And I had an opportunity to start working part-time at a small local winery, which originally gave me some money to go out on the weekends while I was in school and, you know, help pay for college. At any rate, one thing led to another. As I discovered wine and winemaking, working at this small winery, I became just enthralled with the whole concept and shifted gears away from medicine and more into medicinal products.
Nice.
Prior to that realization that I wanted to get into the wine business, I did have a very interesting introduction, and it was picking Montebello Cabernet Sauvignon at Ridge Vineyards, a very famous vineyard down in the Santa Cruz Mountains. We just took a field trip from college, and they were looking for people to help bring in the harvest. And I had never tasted a wine grape, didn't really know what they looked like, and that was a very interesting beginning for me to consider something like this. So that was a few years ago, let's say. I've been doing this. I think this harvest will be my 33rd.
Wow. 33 years. Although it's sort of funny in a way, isn't it, for you, because it's 33 vintages. This doesn't seem like a whole lot, does it?
Depends on how you look at it. Winemaking is one of the things that I really enjoy about it is there's an opportunity for learning and growth every year. Nature can throw you a curveball. This year, for example, was quite dry. We're having a mini drought this spring. And so as a result, the vines are growing differently this year than they have other years. And so there's always, as you can imagine, a million different things that are going to influence the outcome. And so that's exciting to see the impact of the weather and the seasons. And then in addition to that, there's just a lot of very interesting technical advances and techniques, in some cases moving forward, in some cases going back to some ancient techniques, that they all have an impact on the flavor of the wine. They all, you can look at it in the context of where we are today and where they were a couple thousand years ago making wine.
In terms of when you got into the business, did you end up going to school, or are you one of those people who taught themselves, and what was it like back then?
Well, I graduated from UC Santa Cruz down the Monterey Bay Area, and they did not have a specific viticulture and oenology, the study of grapevines and the study of winemaking. So they had a couple classes that I availed myself to, and as I was taking biology and chemistry, I was trying to learn about the winemaking practices, and then I had on-the-job training, which I think is the most valuable.
That's a big difference too, isn't it? It's typical of school where you learn the theory, learn sort of maybe guidelines, but when you're in the trenches, it's a different world, right?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. And as I said, every season is a little different. It's very empirical. You go on your gut feeling sometimes about what's the proper path and on what's been successful in the past history. And then, of course, there's a big background of theory overlaying that. But oftentimes, it's just an intuitive sense. And that's where the artful and creative side of the business comes in.
I guess some of that's sort of getting into with Mother Nature to a degree, right? I mean, is that a fair way to put it?
Yes. Well, certainly you have to understand what's going on in terms of the season and the climate, and then what impact that's going to have on the grape. So, for example, predicting an early harvest this year, because we had very dry spring, the soil warmed up earlier than normal, so bloom earlier than normal, the flowering of the grapevines when pollination occurs and the actual grape berries are formed. And so everything is going to be a little more accelerated this year. There's a number of different characteristics that the wine will have as a result of that. So kind of anticipating, you know, troubleshooting before the big event of Harvest Day.
Mm-hmm. It's funny because you had 11, which was a later harvest last year, which everybody was saying they could have gone on vacation. The wine could have made itself, which of course we know that's not true. And now you have an earlier one. Is this a weather pattern thing, do you think, or is it just fairly typical considering how many years you've been doing this?
Well, my observation, of course, everyone talks about climate change and global warming, and certainly the interior of the U.S. and North America has changed dramatically. Temperatures have been warmer the last few years. For us, dramatically, they've been cooler most years. And the coastal influence that we have from the Pacific Ocean, as things warm up in the interior, it tends to pull the fog and the wind in. Since we're close to the ocean, we're impacted quite dramatically from that. So sometimes you don't get exactly what you expect. If everyone's saying global warming, we're seeing a little global cooling here locally. Although this year, we'll see. It's too early to say, of course. We could have a very warm summer, unpredictable at the moment.
So with 012, I mean, did you have that feeling? It was sort of like the wine could make itself, all due respect.
I've seen in a few years, over 33 years, a few vintages where it's just perfect ripening conditions. So the old adage that the vines have to suffer to make good wine is not always correct. In a year where the grape tissues and the leaves are in very, very healthy state, there's ample water supply and nutrient supply and moderate temperatures, because grapevines will suffer quite a bit in excessive heat. So that will change the dynamics of the ripening and the flavor of the wines as well. So 2012 was just one of those years where the vines were very happy and they produced some magnificent wines, very, very good depth and also high quantity as well, which is somewhat unusual that you have an ample harvest and a very high quality harvest.
Sure. Because of the way it was in 12, this idea of it being such a great year, I've heard a lot of winemakers will look back at other years like 9 and 10 in particular as being something they prefer more versus the perfect growing conditions. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, each of the vintages obviously yields some different basic chemistry in the grapes, you know, pH and acid balance, things like that. Cooler years tend to have a little bit higher acidity and also perhaps a little bit more intense tannin structure. And so the acidity and the tannin will often lend a little bit more stability to the wine, perhaps making them a little bit longer aging. A vintage that I would compare to 2012 is 1997, which also was fairly large harvest. It was considered, you know, when the wines were released, the vintage of the decade. And the 97s are still holding up quite well. Another vintage, 98, which was decried by the critics, is holding up even better than the 97. So, you know, it's always hard to predict exactly what the longevity is, but certainly in terms of sheer enjoyment, 2012 is a fruit-forward vintage. It would be very good for early drinking, and I think it will be good to lay down. 2009 and 10 are a little bit more structured wines, a little higher tannins, I think. Of those two vintages, I think I prefer 2010 a little bit over 2009.
When you say that, I'm sure you're saying as a generalization, are you talking about your own wines? And
well, our own wines, and because we're in Napa Valley, it's usually the reference grape is Cabernet Sauvignon. Napa Valley Cabernet, that's what is on everyone's mind.
Sure. I've heard of that grape before somewhere. I don't recall where. How long have you been making wine here at the Castle?
I started in 2005. So spring of 2005, my first vintage here was that fall. And a small amount of wine had been made, a very, very tiny amount of wine had been made the previous year. Mm-hmm. In 2005, the Castle was still under construction. We were nearing, I think it was year 12 at that point. We still had another year and a half, almost two more years of construction before the public was first invited here. So the first couple of years, we were making wine in a construction zone, which is always very challenging.
Got to be kind of different. Of course, then again, your focus is making the wine, nothing going on around you, I'm sure, in the long run, right?
This place is so impressive. And of course, focusing on the wine, so sometimes I got my blinders on. I'm not even realizing, you know, how gorgeous of a location I work in. I feel very fortunate.
I imagine to a degree, you take it for granted. As we walked in through the courtyard, of course, you have this beautiful view of the mountains. And it's kind of like, well, you go to work, you're focused on the wine. This is what I've got to accomplish today.
Yes. Well, it's always fun to entertain and invite people to come and visit the Castle, taste the wines, because it is a wonderful place to see. And hopefully, you know, the wines make it all worthwhile, as we've done quite well with getting accolades of the press. It's worked out well.
So let's talk about the Castle. We're in this incredible little room that's half inside, half outside. What I read up on, this took 15 years to build this amazing structure. Tell me a little bit about it. I don't know if you can even say a little bit.
Well, I'll try to give you lots of information, but not be too lengthy. The concept began with the owner, Dario Situi, who's Italian heritage. His great-grandfather had come over and started a winery called V. Situi Winery over in San Francisco in 1885. And through the 1906 earthquake and prohibition, the winery closed sometime before Dario became aware of it, before he was born. At any rate, he had always thought in the back of his mind that he might like to resurrect that brand, and he did in 1975 in St. Helena at V. Situi Winery. And he had been looking for some property, some land for his home site, essentially for a few years. He came upon this location, Castello di Amorosa. At the time, the owner had plans for a very small winery, but had not really started construction. So Dario inherited this winery use permit and a plan for a small winery when he purchased his property. Initially, I don't think he had any intention of making a second winery. As things progressed, and as he became more and more excited about the possibilities here, he was also a student of medieval architecture, had traveled through Europe extensively, and of course the areas where his great-grandparents came from. So he would always travel with a sketchbook or camera, and as he would go to new locations and see old historic castles, he liked to get out his tape measure and say, oh, well, what is this arch radius? And what is, you know, so as he had an opportunity to build what initially started as a small Italian villa, about 8,000 square feet, over 15 years it morphed into 121,000 square foot, 107 room castle.
You use the word small three times. Nothing applies.
Well, that's right. Well, Dario Situi is not small either. He's very tall. And so everything here is big.
What's nice about this is, though it certainly is a tourist place that's exceptional, especially once you come through the trees and you see the first view of the castle, your jaw drops. But you are making the wine here, and that's important.
Ultimately, that's, we're hoping the big draw is that we're establishing a real reputation for the quality of our wines. Another thing I should mention that's a little unusual about this place is that we sell all our wines just direct to the consumer. You can only buy them here at on-site or through our website, and that's very unusual. Most wineries will go through retailers or restaurateurs, but the only way to get our wine is to come here.
Well, that gives you a good reason to come to see the castle as well as to taste the wine. About how many cases are you guys doing?
We're approaching almost 25,000 cases.
So it's still, I'm going to use the word now myself, it's still a small winery.
Yes, it is. It's a small family-run winery. That's what it is. And unfortunately, there's not a lot of those left in California through a lot of mergers and acquisitions. Many brands have been gobbled up. Many small family brands have been gobbled up. And so that's very refreshing, personally, to be working for a family business.
I imagine you have to have a fair amount of pride to be able to come to a structure like this to work, regardless of it being day-to-day. I mean, this is pretty cool.
We've had a lot of projects. We've always tried to implement some innovations on the wine side, new equipment. We're in the process of building a new 15,000 square foot underground barrel storage cave. So that will allow us to continue to slowly expand our production.
Well, I noticed when I drove up, there was something going on in the drive. Is that your property as well?
Yes. That's actually Dario Satui's home. You may have noticed the old Victorian down by the highway.
Right.
And then between there and the driveway is new construction for the castle, and this is a farm building. So it's where we'll be storing all of our tractors and trailers and then some other storage. You would think with 107 rooms, storage wouldn't be an issue, but we're always looking for places to put materials and supplies. And so that's going to give us a little bit more storage here, which will be great.
Yeah, with 25,000 cases, you wouldn't think it would be a monstrous operation, but still, like anything else, you have to have a place for everything to go.
Yeah, moving supplies in and out. Bottles tend to take up the most room, it seems like, when we're bottling. So,
well, the idea would be to have people take them home with them. That's the story. So tell me about the wine that you're making here. Obviously, Cabernet is king, certainly in Napa Valley.
We have many varieties that people would recognize from Italy. For example, Sangiovese, Barbera, and even wines from northern Italy, D'Alto Adige, Pinot Blanc or Pinot Bianco, Pinot Grigio, of course, which is a very popular white wine from Italy. We also make some sweet Muscats and an unusual sweet red wine that's Frizzante style, sparkling, called Fantasia. La Fantasia, a very interesting wine. It's been very popular. As well as traditional reds, Pinot Noir, Merlot, and Cabernet Sauvignon. We're also making some single vineyard Cabernets from very small vineyards. Some blended wines, some wines that people may have heard of called Super Tuscans. Super Tuscan is a term used in Tuscany in areas where they're growing some varieties that are non-traditional varieties. Sangiovese being the traditional variety, Cabernet Sauvignon, Cabernet Franc, Merlot, and Bordeaux-style reds being the unusual ones. And so when those grapes are grown and made into wine over in Tuscany, they're often referred to as Super Tuscan.
Do you guys ever think you'd go into a territory sort of like a Montepulciano, anything a little less well-known in this area?
We have looked at various other varieties. We bottled a Vermentino this year, which is Italian white, very crisp white wine, known for its citrusy character. And it's a lovely wine with seafood, you know, lighter fare. So we're always adding, it seems like every year we're adding one or two more varieties or blends. We have a wine called La Castellana, which is we refer to as a Super Tuscan. It's usually about 70% plus or minus Cabernet and 15 Merlot and Sangiovese. A wine that we're going to be coming out with from the 2012 harvest will be probably closer to 50-50 Sangiovese, Cabernet Sauvignon. So as we're making these blends, we're cutting new ground here and learning ourselves as we do so.
Sangiovese is not a common grape around here. There are a couple of wineries I know of making it, but not very many.
I believe this is true. We're probably the largest producer of varietal Sangiovese in Napa Valley. Sangiovese has had kind of a mixed history. It was originally planted fairly extensively and was popular in the 1980s, but I think perhaps it wasn't planted in the ideal locations, and perhaps the winemakers didn't quite understand the grape. You do have to understand what your raw materials are and where you want to go with it, obviously. Our Sangiovese is very well received, but in the past, the American palate hasn't always been so. Chianti Classico is great with Italian pasta, and because one of the reasons it's such a great food wine is the acidity, inherent acidity. When you're growing it over here, at least my experience was with a lot of the American palates, they would find it too acidic. And so we're doing a couple of things, for example, picking a little bit later, just being patient until some of that natural acidity resolves itself in the vineyard.
You know, we run through fads here in the United States. You know, we had the anti-Merlot thing, we had the Pinot Noir thing. I mean, do you think something like Sangiovese, you know, is it one that might slip into that mainstream one day for people?
There's a possibility. It's in profile, you might say it's somewhat similar to Pinot Noir. It's a lighter bodied red, and as such, that makes it often, you know, as I said, a good food choice. I can only speak from our experience, and our Sangiovese sells out every year. So we have a lot of avid Sangiovese fans. Whether it will, you know, pick up steam and move on from there? I'm not sure. I've noticed that a few other producers are making Sangiovese. Some are sourcing it from down the Paso Robles area, some out for the Sierra foothills, warmer regions. We also have about six different Sangiovese vineyards, and each one will produce a different style wine. And so by blending them together, I can get a fairly consistent style from year to year. They do change in characteristics very much depending on site and local microclimate.
Are you sourcing grapes? Are they estate? Are you sourcing from leases?
We have about 30 acres of estate vineyards just right here at the castle, and we're in the Diamond Mountain District, the Diamond Mountain AVA, sub-appellation of Napa Valley. But we also own a vineyard up in Anderson Valley, out by Mendocino. Anderson Valley is closer to the coast, a little more cool climate, excellent Pinot Noir. Excellent. That's where we got our Gewurztraminer. It's fabulous Gewurztraminer from out there, as well as a couple other varieties. And then the balance of what we produce here are purchased through either single-year or multi-year grape purchase agreements with local growers.
Not a lot of people even up that way growing Gewurztraminer that I'm aware of.
Well, actually, Anderson Valley has a reputation for a Gewurztraminer. A winery that started many, many years ago is Navarro, and they were kind of put Gewurztraminer on the map for Anderson Valley. But I personally really think that it's a wonderful match. That variety has the spicy, lychee aromas that were very fruity. And it also, because of the cooler climate, it takes a little bit longer to ripen, and so it really develops some wonderful flavors. Gewurztraminer is an interesting variety in that you can make it in several different styles. For example, we have a dry, bone-dry Gewurztraminer that we ferment in a concrete tank, shaped like an egg. And this is, at the beginning, I was saying we've tried some old tricks and new tricks. And so the use of concrete is kind of a going back to the future for a lot of people.
Right.
It makes a very interesting wine. And then we have a couple different levels, one that's sort of slightly sweeter, which we call our Anderson Valley, one that's a little sweeter than that, and then a late harvest botrytized wine, which has won the sweepstakes, the dessert wine sweepstakes at the San Francisco Chronicle competition the last 2 years in a row. And it's only of, I think there's over 5,000 wines entered, and there's only four wines that get a sweepstakes. So we feel very lucky that we were impressing the judges with that wine. And so Gewurztraminer has really worked for us. It's a variety that a lot of wineries don't make. We're really happy with the result.
And again, a lot of wine drinkers who really know their wine love Gewurztraminer, and it's just one of those you got to have late harvest. That's got to be good.
We also make another dessert wine, somewhat modeled after the Sauternes blends, Semillon and Sauvignon Blanc, called Il Pasito. Those wines are so fabulous to follow when they age, because they do age generally very, very long. 15, 20 is not uncommon, you know, for those wines to go 25 years. So they're really fun wines. I feel fortunate that we have the opportunity to make so many different wines, because a lot of my colleagues who are in national distribution, they might have 6, 8 wines, maybe 5 for the broad market, and maybe 3 or 4 for the tasting room that they produce in small quantities, and we're over 25 wines here.
That's a lot of wine.
It is.
It's hard to remember from time to time, I got to believe. Brooks, this has been great talking to you, and it's really fun to be able to, and I've only got just a kind of a glance at the castle right at this point. This would be a place I would tell people to come to see, but tell me a little bit about accessibility and hours and that sort of thing for the castle here.
We welcome visitors 7 days a week. I think there's only 3 days when we're closed. We always recommend that people make a call and a reservation in advance, especially during the summer months, and especially during weekends. We want to make sure that you and your party can get in, and so that's always what we suggest. Usually, if you're going on a tour, you're going to be treated to a 45-minute or an hour tour, go through all the lower cellars, go to our torture chamber and armory. If you have a castle, of course, you need one of each of those. We're very flexible hours, and if you do make a call in advance, we're very accommodating. We love to, you know, take care of any special guests or special needs.
And how would our listeners find out about you online?
Well, Castello di Amorosa, it's a mouthful, .com, www.castellodiamorosa, and there's lots of information about our wines. You can order the wines from that website as well as make a reservation and learn quite a bit about the castle and its origins.
And I think if they just Googled the castle, Napa Valley would probably come up as well.
Yes. Numerous articles and references, as well as our own website.
And you have a wine club as well, right?
We do. We have a wine club. People who visit us, they may be from just 20, 30 miles away, or they may be a couple thousand miles away, and they get on our wine list, and we have a selection, different selections that they can make, and we send them a bottle every month, every third month, whatever they desire.
And most importantly, it's a wine that you can only get from here, so it's really special.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're not going to find this in a restaurant or retail shop in the world.
Excellent. Brooks, I can't thank you enough for taking your Memorial Day off to come in and to talk to us. I really appreciate it.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thanks, Ray.
Learn more about the castle by visiting castellodiamorosa.com. Thank you for listening, and watch for our next program featuring Craig Hazarow, co-owner of Sojourn Cellars in Sonoma. Life Between the Vines was produced at Fifth Floor Recording Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. Produced and edited by Ray Pfister. Original music by Tim Turton. Our intern is Steve Lance. Web design by Jenny Holland. Our web geek is Tim Panicucci. Photos by Jeanette Herniak. Copyright 2013.